Do you ever go to a museum or gallery and wonder how on earth an artist came up with that?
So I started playing with shea butter probably about 12 or 13 years ago.
This is Rashid Johnson. He's a rising star in contemporary art.
I was sitting in my bathroom listening to a show on National Public Radio. It was the Tavis Smiley Show.
Oh, yeah.
Used to come on at 2 p.m. So I was sitting in my bathroom listening to the Tavis Smiley Show and putting on shea butter. And I got a call from a friend. He asked me what I was doing.
Sitting in the bathtub listening to public radio. Yeah.
Putting on shea butter.
Shea butter.
And he said, oh, that sounds like a really interesting work.
Okay, that wouldn't be my reaction, but we're talking about how artists work.
It kind of led to me thinking about how complicated the material was, its relationship to Africa and an Africanness.
Because it's from West Africa, right, shea butter?
It is. It's a West African material that comes from a nut. It's often put in a lot of different products that we use today, even jergens and different lotions.
Pretty much everybody has put shea butter on their skin. They just may not realize it.
Everybody is using shea butter and they may not realize it. So they are all engaging in some sort of relationship with Africa that they may not necessarily be aware that they are.
We're standing in front of one of Rashid Johnson's newest works in a one-man show at the Milwaukee Art Museum. It's a long, heavy wooden table piled with big sculptural blocks of shea butter. And when you get close, you can see that the table itself has been burned in places. It looks almost like a ritual.
It is kind of a ritual experience. I built a large forge, and then I have these steel brands. Some of them are kind of like gun sights. Others are just circles, triangles. But the steel brands go into the forge and are heated almost like a cattle brand. And then it burns into the table. So there's this scarring or this scarification of the material. And by placing the shea butter on top of it, you kind of imagine beginning the healing process for those scars.
Yeah. So what began as a private moment in a bathtub turned into a piece full of historical allusions to slavery and colonial trade. This is what fascinates me about Rashid Johnson. He's always thinking about the complicated relationship, the push and pull between individual and collective identity. The biggest piece here is actually a box or a room, four sides of open black scaffolding spilling over with tropical plants, an organ, and books. Lots of books. This is just spectacular. It's like we're looking at a gigantic bookcase, but then with all this lush greenery.
And the plants are all from different places. So you have kind of cactus, you have palms, you have all of these disparate plants from different places kind of living together in a way. I think it's almost a metaphor for the collective us in some ways.
How does the organist even get in there?
They have to kind of climb in, and then they have to kind of force their body up into the middle of the space. So it's kind of a trying experience, but I think it's more rewarding when you get inside.
Have you gone in there yourself and sat in there?
I spent quite a bit of time inside of the sculpture. It's a really interesting place to be. It feels kind of like a womb in some way, but it feels warm and you feel kind of alone, even though there are people standing around, but they can't necessarily see you so well.
Can we look at some of the books?
Sure.
Which ones are most important to you?
I guess one that I think is really interesting is a book by W.E.B. Du Bois, The Souls of Black Folk. And Du Bois is a scholar and writer, all around kind of brilliant race man is what he at different times called himself. There's a book by Deborah Dickerson called The End of Blackness, which explores the idea of blackness being kind of an antiquated way of exploring what identity and what culture is.
Mm-hmm. Your mother's a professor of African history?
My mother is a professor of African history with an emphasis on post-colonial feminist theory.
So you grew up in a house filled with books?
I grew up in a house filled with books. A lot of incredibly intimidating titles like Harold Cruz, The Crisis of the Negro Intellectual, as well as a lot of important canonized literary figures.
So you grew up, your mom's a professor of African colonial history. There was that period when she was wearing dashikis. You're a child of the Afrocentric generation, child of the Black Power generation. What did that mean, like, in your family growing up?
It was an incredibly prideful thing in my family growing up. We celebrated Kwanzaa. We were very involved in, you know, learning some Swahili and lighting of the candles. In a lot of ways, I felt like we grew up without the idea of imagining ourselves as victims. I was raised truly believing the idea of black being beautiful. You know, that can be complicated because just because you don't see yourself as a victim doesn't mean that you're not subject to victimhood.
As you can imagine, one of the first things a young man with that kind of upbringing would want to do is visit Africa, the place he'd been hearing stories about all his life.
I didn't get to travel to Africa until I was 19 years old. A friend and I worked in public works, like kind of garbage special pickup to save money to send ourselves. And I made it there by age 19, and I was able to visit Du Bois's house in Ghana.
That must have been incredible. What's his house like?
You know, it was pretty amazing. One of the materials that kind of came out of it for me was that he had all these beautiful Persian rugs, and I thought to myself, wow, what was his obsession with these rugs? And it kind of led to me exploring that material as well.
So you had this childhood in which, you know, your family and so many people at the time were really focused on in what ways are we African?
Right.
And so what was that like?
I wasn't African in a lot of ways that Africans identified as African. And my experience was different, my narrative was different, and my history was different. And I realized just how Western I was when I got there.
Thus began the reinvention of Rashid Johnson.
It really made me dig into kind of how my own personal exploration didn't necessarily need to be married to a collective idea of place in order to kind of fulfill for me what the journey would look like going forward.
This is a theme Rashid Johnson comes back to over and over again in his work, place. You're part of a group of four artists, right, who just collectively pooled some money to buy Nina Simone's home?
We did. And I think it kind of comes back to the experience getting an opportunity to visit Du Bois' house and just how important it was for me that it was his home and that these kinds of spaces, when we save them and when we're given the opportunity to visit them and cherish them, that we learn so much about the people who actually occupied those spaces and those homes.
What is that, do you think? Because I've had the same experience. There's nothing like visiting a writer or artist's house, the place where they did their work. I don't know, you see their bedroom, you see their bathroom, the dishes that they ate off of. I don't know why it should matter so much, but it does.
It really does. There's a poetry of place. You know, it's hard to explain, but it's something that I know personally from experience, and I think it's important to make sure that in times like these, especially with what's happening in places like North Carolina, where you have the Voting Rights Act being challenged so aggressively, that we make sure that we are able to save certain kinds of spaces and make sure that people in those places know that we care.
Why you wanna fly, blackbird? You ain't ever gonna fly.
Rashid Johnson. He's the subject of a new exhibition at the Milwaukee Art Museum, and you can take a look at it on our website at ttbook.org.
No place big enough for holding all the tears you're gonna